Yeah. Well, good morning. First, I would like to thank for the invitation to come to this very interesting place and to give a talk also today. And the talk will be on biogenesis. I have given you a shorter version of the title. And this is a report over some work in Heidelberg for some longer period, together with PhD students, or no, former PhD students, and also for some longer time with Tomislav Prokopić. Now the subject, biogenesis, and that I would like to stress, is deeply connected to cosmology on one side and elementary particle physics on the other side, which is very interesting. I mean, the progress in elementary particle physics some long time ago led to all these beautiful results in cosmology. It was a standard model, and if you look to the books of Weinberg, for example, it was really surprising what you can do really with the standard model. So, elementary particle physics was kind of the leading power there, yes, and then all these things you dreamed in cosmology could make a little bit more concrete. And nowadays we have new fascinating observations, and this is mostly related to structure formation. So on one side, I mean, as these observations here, the cosmic microwave background, and then you observe galaxies, gravitational lensing, very beautiful results. And on the theoretical side, then you can really proceed to explain structure formation. And the whole thing is based then on inflation and some idea about dark matter. And it's kind of a crux, but also a nice thing that these two things are not very concrete. So you can have inflation, I mean, in many, many occasions, so it's not very concrete, and so you don't know. You don't know the exact physics, which is presumably a non-standard model physics, yes, which is behind inflation, for example, but you still can work with it very successfully. And the same is true for dark matter. Now, biogenesis, which nowadays is a rather the baryon asymmetry, the observed baryon asymmetry is it's a very exact number nowadays, due to the WMAP data. I mean, because the baryon content of the universe has some influence, yes, of the sound velocity, and so you get this nice number, which is in agreement with the old data of early nucleosynthesis, but it's much much more precise. On the other side, of course, this preciseness doesn't help you too much. I mean, it's just one number, yeah? So you have just one number to explain. The interesting thing with biogenesis is that there is quite a lot of elementary particle physics which goes into models. And you all know it's very old, these necessary conditions of Sakharov, I mean, to get creation of a baryon asymmetry in the universe, you need something which violates baryon number. So these are grand unified models, or nowadays, I mean, lepton number violation first, yes, with Majorana neutrinos. Very important, and most important maybe, is Electrovic's Veyleron, which I will tell you a little bit later. But you also then need C and CP violation. Well, in the standard model, you have the KM matrix, But in non-standard theories, of course, you have many more occasions to introduce CP violation. And last not least, and this will be the point I will concentrate in this talk, you need non-equilibrium, which is the subject of our workshop. And so that can be the, of course, whatever you do in cosmology is non-equilibrium. The universe is expanding, so you have out of equilibrium decay, yes, which was already used long ago. And but more impressive are you also might have phase transitions. So these are the sources of non-equilibrium. And so what I have to talk to you is really standard, I mean, old-fashioned quantum field theory, yeah, in a sense. Yes. So I was, I should maybe say it here, yes, I was really surprised, not negative surprised, but I was surprised to see that the field of string theory, just from the technical side with ADS-CFT, but also a string cosmology has entered the fields. Yes, and up to now, I always understood that these are two different boxes, and I, fortunately, I'm related, yes, to both boxes, yes, but they have been separate boxes, and so it's a completely new thing. On the other side, of course, one has to say if you talk about non-equilibrium, then string theory, I am sure, is not able. I mean, there's no dynamics in string theory, the formulation of genuine string dynamics. Yes, so you always have to go to some effective theory, and which is an ordinary field theory, and then you go on. Yes, so string theory is more something for the beginning. Yes, but not really. It wouldn't help you to discuss non-equilibrium. Now, of course, there are many, many models here. Yes, you have these three conditions, but then the models, that is not unique what you do. And though in a talk of Misha Shapovnikov some longer time ago, he said he would have 43 models. Yes, so, of course, since he is, I guess, the number one model, so he was in a good shape to tell, yes, but there are quite a few possibilities, yes. And now I have to make a selection, and the selection, of course, is influenced by what I did myself with my collaborators, and I will concentrate on two type of models. One, this is, so to speak, the first model of baryogenesis, saying that the electroweak phase transition is creates baryon asymmetry. Yes, that's a very old story. And so what you need there, and we had this nice talk 2 weeks ago of David Morrissey. I mean, he was going more into the details of elementary particle physics. And what you need is the first order phase transition, so tied here such a potential with a bump. And then you have here two phases. You have a symmetric phase, the hot phase, and you have a Higgs phase, where you have a quasi-classical Higgs expectation value. And this happens at energies of 100 GeV. And what is also very important here is the Svaleron transition, so a violation of B plus L in the electroweak theory. The other model I will talk about is more towards the end, is because the, it's completely different. It's completely different, but on the other side, the techniques are not so different. Yes, so it might be interesting to see. That is what we call coherent baryogenesis. So there is the idea that you create some charge asymmetry, which is not baryon asymmetry, towards the end of inflation, or say hybrid inflation, particularly nice. And then you have lepton number violation because you produce a Majorana neutrino, and then you change the lepton violation into baryon violation with the Svaleron. So just a few words about the Svaleron. I mean, though, let me see. Miko is you're both Dietrich is in the audience, and this is the rough form of the Sphaleron transition. So in the Higgs phase, you have here some suppression. In the hot phase, there is no suppression, and of course here there are some well-known prefactors. So it's actually is alpha to the fifth, and you also have a logarithm, and that was nicely found out some 10 years ago, and maybe less, a little bit less. And so the interesting thing is that so this Sphaleron transition is unsuppressed in the symmetric phase, and then if you get into the Higgs phase, it is strongly suppressed if there is a strong first-order phase transition. And what is violated is actually B plus L. And now with this Sphaleron, you have two possibilities. I mean, you start with inflation, so there are no particles at all. So B is zero, L is zero. Yes. Now you have pre- and reheating. You create particles, and okay. Now it depends: is B minus L violated or not? Yes. If it's not violated, B minus L is zero. Yes. And then later on, in this equilibrium phase of the hot plasma, B plus L goes to zero because of the Sphaleron. So B and L is zero, and then you have to start. At the electroweak phase transition, you have to start creating a baryon asymmetry. That is one possibility. The other one is that, indeed, I mean, you produce already here in this stadium, you produce already some baryon or lepton number, and then later on, this is then transformed into a baryon asymmetry, which will be the case in our second model. But now let me start with the electroweak case. Well, this is an old figure. Yes, you have this bubble of a first-order phase transition, a bubble with the Higgs phase inside. You have a profile of this bubble, and in this bubble wall, Cp is violated, and you have here diffusion in this hot plasma, and you create some asymmetry, and then later on, by the hot Sphaleron, this is transformed into baryon, into a baryon asymmetry, which, if this bubble is, which is extending here with some fraction of the velocity of light, if the bubble here takes over, then this baryon asymmetry has to freeze out very fast, which means that you should have a strongly first-order phase transition. Now, if you look to elementary particle physics, of course, it's the first thing which comes to your mind is it might be the standard model because, yeah, Cp is violated. But as Kayo and Mikko and Rumukain, they found out a very nice result that if the Higgs is heavier than the W mass, which indeed should be true, then there is no phase transition at all. And right from the beginning, of course, also in the standard model, there was this problem that Cp violation via the Ka matrix is very small. So you have to do something. And nowadays, of course, everybody wants to have a variant of the standard model. Yes, so you might go to supersymmetric variants. But what you have to do is you have to increase the phi to the third term. Yes, because so look to our potential. Here we have this thermal phi square term. Then you have here a phi to the third term with a minus sign, which gives you this bump of a first order phase transition. Then it goes up again with phi to the fourth. So you have to increase that. And you can do that in the minimal supersymmetric standard model via a stop. And okay, I don't discuss that here in any detail, but you also can go then to next to minimal or nearly minimal supersymmetric standard models where you have already such a kind of phi to the third term on the tree level. Yes, here in the minimal model, you generated here with a one-loop graph. In the other case, you already have it at tree level, which has some advantages. It's then really not suppressed, and you don't have to here to fix here a very tiny a very tiny section, yes, of the possibilities of the for your parameters. Yes, it's very restricted. The MSSM is very restricted. Yes, so you have a restriction to the S-topaz, to the Higgs, and some other restrictions. It's a very restrictive game nowadays. And okay, and concerning CP violation, of course, you are also better off if you look to the MSSM or to some other models of the type, because then you are free to have you have many more possibilities to violate CP. Of course, there are some restrictions because there are experimental bounds on the electric dipole moments. So this is very restrictive and a rather technical discussion. What is very nice and which I have not seen very much in the literature is a kind of spontaneous violation of CP. That would be very interesting if you have a spontaneous CP violation just in a particular temperature range. Yes. So if it cools down to temperature zero, our laboratory, there would be now a CP violation just in the range of the phase transition. You could have a CP violation. We found such a case. Well, it turned out, we remember, it turned out that in the MSSM it's not possible, but in these extended models it's possible to construct such a case where you have a spontaneous violation of CP. Now, let's come to the electroweak baryogenesis. This is a longer story. I mean, there are many steps to go, and the nice thing is that each step can be improved and you can do it better and better. It's a rather clear procedure, yes, but painful because there are many steps. And of course, the first thing, you look to your first order phase transition, you look to this critical bubble, the profile of the bubble, then you find out transition probabilities, then you discuss supercooling and formation of a critical bubble. Then you discuss that this bubble, after some time, yes, is expanding stationary, and you calculate the wall velocity here. Of the wall velocity, if the bubble is big enough, I mean, you have just you don't have a sphere anymore, just you have a wall in some direction, and you can calculate the this wall velocity. This is all not the subject of my talk today. Our subject today should be the transport. Yeah? The transport in presence of a moving phase boundary with CP violating effects. So, and in the MSSM, which I will mostly concentrate, it will be then quantum transport equations for Charginos. And after that, then you have then we will stop again. We have created a chiral asymmetry, so between left-handed quarks and the antiparticles, and then the Hertz phaleron, which of course is not in equilibrium, otherwise it would erase the baryon asymmetry again. The Hertz phaleron transforms into baryons, yeah, at the very end of the procedure. Now, diffusion in presence of a moving wall, since it turns out that these walls are thick walls, which means if this is the dimension of the wall, it's much larger than the mean free path of the particles in the hot medium, and also the wavelengths, the thermal wavelengths of the particles, yes, is much smaller than the thickness of the wall. So you would think I do a quasi-classical description, a WKB approximation, and indeed that is not wrong at all, and it gives partly right results. There's a problem, and this is now something which you might not be familiar with if you just discuss the relation, a quantum transport and Boltzmann equation. You are not used to the situation that you have CP violation. So in this case here, it turns out that there is a difference between the kinetic momentum and the canonical momentum. You have to pick the kinetic momentum, and then, okay, you get your spectrum. And then what I also have done long years ago with Stefan Huber, you just plug that into the Boltzmann equation, yes? And since the Boltzmann equation gives you I've not worked it out here, but then the Boltzmann equation gives you some semi-classical force. But this is not clear yet, that you just take a spectrum, you put it into the Boltzmann equation, and that still works to order h bar. Yes, so you, because you have CP violation. So we wanted to check that and made a first principle derivation of the semi-classical force, and then you start from the Kellish formalism, and we took fermionic fields. One also can take bosonic ones, but this is in this order here it gives zero. Yes, and so you take fermionic fields, and the simplest model you can do is just to take a complex fermionic mass, where the CP violation is now here, sitting in this theta parameter, which depends on x, yes? So x is the, or sometimes it will be in my talk z, yes? The direction perpendicular to the bubble wall. And, this is here your Lagrangian, and the central quantity is GLS, yes? That's our quantity we always work with, yeah? We had, following during a little bit other combinations, yes, but we take GLS, and then does this Wigner transform, which leads you to something like a classical phase space, yes, that you, I don't have to explain you, and you get the Baim-Kadanoff equations here, and you see what is interesting here, so this, what I called here M hat, is kind of a Moyal operator, yeah? So it's a mixing of derivatives with respect to x and k, and of course, if you do a derivative expansion, you just take here the lowest terms in this exponential expansion. And to make things easier, you since the wall is proceeding with constant velocity, you can go to the wall frame for a while, yes? Of course, that is then not the frame where you have the temperature is at the bars, yes? It's at rest, yes? But you take the wall frame. And there's some nice thing. It turns out that the spin perpendicular to the wall is conserved. And so if this is here the general expression with some Pauli matrices here for the spin and here for up and down, it turns out that the whole thing cooks down for two amplitudes which have a fixed spin. And I have to say, that's an important point. I have put now the collision term for a while to zero. That is, of course, not in the spirit of this workshop, yes, so we have to talk later about, yes, what happens with the collision term, yes? Will you give you some interesting damping, yes? But so this conservation of spin, if you don't have this collision term, is it's okay. And then you cook down to four amplitudes, and the four amplitudes you can cook down then to one amplitude, which is here the zero component of a vector. And you easily read off here the dispersion relation, so the spectrum, and this agrees with the WKB, yes, if you have this momentum, it's a kinetic momentum, then it agrees. And now, of course, we are not allowed to put that into the Boltzmann equation, but we, how did we get here this equation? We took you can take the real imaginary part of your fundamental equations, and the real part gives you here the constraint, and the other then gives you the transport equation, and the transport
equation works because you have two phases, but this equation works only in one phase or in two phases?
No, the whole this equation now is it's in the it's the boundary of the of your bubble, yes? I mean, so it's you have a change, yes? It's you have a profile, yes? And the Higgs is inside the bubble. This is the usual value, yes? So, well, depending on temperature, but then if you go outside, outside is zero, yeah?
Yes, but for this one, I'm asking, where from you know in which phase you are? This mass?
Well, yes. The mass. I have here just written a mass, but that would be just the Higgs expectation value, yes? The Higgs expectation value, yeah? So in that simple case, I mean, the fermionic mass is given by the Higgs expectation value, yeah?
But there is a little problem then, because such a derivation assumes gradient expansion. So
yeah.
The system should be very smooth at the phase boundary.
Yeah.
The system is not smooth at all, so...
There might be
very important contributions from the higher order derivatives. And you keep on the...
But it doesn't have to be like that, and m of x can vary slowly enough for the equation to hold.
So you must assume that the wall is sufficiently... Everything happens at the wall in a sufficiently smooth way.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of an... It's a quasi-classical field, yes? Yeah, that's an interesting point we also will have in my other example, yes. So. Okay, so here we have already done a derivative expansion. You see here the first derivatives of this theta of x of the CP violating phase is entering. Yeah? And now going to the transport equation. So this is the transport equation, and you take out this delta function of the of your spectrum, and you derive here a Vlasov equation. So there's no source now, yeah. And okay, and this then nicely agrees what you get in WKB. Yeah? So you have a quasi-classical force, which is now in second derivative here, second derivative of this theta angle. And so it's an h-bar square effect, yeah, which you get. And of course, then the story is not finished. I mean, you have to boost back to the plasma system and so on, yes? But now, of course, this was not very physical. We want to have a more complicated mass. And so we go to the MSSM. In the MSSM, you look to the Charcino, the Higgsino, Gaetino, mixing matrix, and so your mass is now here a matrix. CP violations are sitting here in the Gaetino, also Vino mass, and here in this mu parameter, these are the Higgses. And now, if you in this case, if you start the same game we did before, then you have a problem, because already in the first order in H bar, the constraint equation is non-algebraic. Yeah, so, I mean, your quasi-particle picture is not okay. And but one still can go on, and our method is not to look to these constraint equations at all, but just look to the transport equation itself, yes, and try to derive a transport equation for some density, okay, where you don't have this particle picture anymore in a strict sense.
What's understood with non-algebraic equation?
Well, you have the derivatives already in the, yeah? It's a differential equation, yes, so... So, and okay, to start a little bit more technical. You have your mass matrix, which is not diagonal. You can diagonalize it, multiplying this to unitary matrices from left and right. And now, as I said, we have four of these amplitudes, and you take that is all a little bit technical and tricky. You take some nice combinations here. 0 and G3 is a vector and axial vector, this combination, so you take this right-left combination here, and you also have this other combination. And then it turns out in general all these G's in the transport equations mix, yes, but If you look to the lowest order in H bar, so order H bar, not zero, but already non-trivial order, yeah, in the derivative, it turns out that these two here don't mix. The mixing is mostly here with the, I mean, you have a mixing between right and left here. And now, if you diagonalize, that is important. If we diagonalize the mass matrix, of course, the G's are not diagonal. Yeah, these are also matrices, and they are not diagonal. So you can split them into a part which is diagonal plus another one which is transversal. And now, in the lowest orders, this diagonal part and the transversal part have different fulfill different dispersion relations, and we concentrate, I mean, to find out a CP violating effect, we concentrate here on this GRT. Yeah? And the nice thing is then we will get an effect, a CP violating effect already in order H bar, so first order derivative in theta, not second order. Yeah? So this is a new thing, and indeed, the group around Carlos Wagner, Marcella, so on, they always claimed, yes, that there is a first order H bar effect, yes, but they did not really present it in a strict way. Yes, so, and finally, also, we don't agree with them, they now agree with us, yes, that we are doing the right thing, but it's not the same, but it's, there are some similarities. And okay, then of course now one has to find the CPU violating source, yes, for this object here, for the transversals, and there's also a little bit of a problem. I mean, which I think nobody else has realized. I mean, the CP violation. If you formulate CP violation in the flavor basis, it's a clear thing. It's a normal thing what you find in the box on CP, yes, CP transformations. But now these rotations in flavor space do not commute with your CP operation. And so you have to reformulate something which commutes, yes? And so this is a little technical step here, yes, that you have here a new, so it comes then to some transposition, that is a technical point. Okay, and then, okay, we get, for these quantities here, we get already to order H bar, a CP violating thing, and now thing, we can proceed as usual, yes, since we are not far away, that also differs here from what some people here in the workshop do. Yes, we are still close to thermal equilibrium. Yes, you start with thermal equilibrium, and then at the end of the procedure, you again have thermal equilibrium. And so we make here a linear response theory, and we calculate here. Now, here these CP violating sources we get out of our equations, and we can solve that. Yes, and except that I have to tell you about something about this term here. Yes, and you see, because we have to get back to equilibrium. Yeah? I mean, up to now we didn't have any collision terms, and we have to get back to equilibrium. But this is only possible, yes, if you have some scattering at the end. Yes, so you should introduce something like reheating or preheating, or I mean some procedure which takes you to equilibrium. And here we have been very very rough. We have put in just here a damping term of appropriate size, the gamma is of the order alpha weak times the temperature. Yes, so just from dimensional arguments, and because you have scattering, we put here some gamma, and we also vary it a little bit. I will show you then the final results where you can see the influence. And then,
Miguel,
yeah?
Before you introduced some constrained equation for some spin components, which was only correct because you throwed away scattering.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you went through all this derivation, and I think it's still in your formula, and now you say you put in some damping that you wouldn't get from scattering. Did you say that?
Yeah, but it's just at the very end. I mean, you have your CP violating effect. Yes, I mean there are two. I mean the collision term here in our case is just not to get CP violation. Yes, so that is also of course a possibility. One has to act very carefully to extract CP violation also from the collision term. And indeed, with Weinstock we did say it. Yes, but that is not the point. Yes,
it doesn't contradict your constraint equations that you used before.
Depends. I mean, of course, that does not fulfill spin conservation. Yes, so
it doesn't matter because you used it before, right, to derive this equation.
No, what? I mean, this is a small effect. Just to lead you back to equilibrium. Yes, it's a different thing. I mean, you violate CP. These are two different effects. You violate CP already in your original equation. Yes, and then. And for that, for this effect, you have the spin conservation. Yes, and but then later you have to find some way to get back to equilibrium. Yes? So, it's, of course, I don't. It would be nice to have that at all in one formalism, but it's. I can warn you, it's terribly complicated. We try it. Yes, and
process as a stationary problem that you have a flux going onto the interface and coming out on the other side, and you just compare, you know, the fluxes. That's input output problem, stationary without all the equations. And then you could do maybe, you know, some higher in H bar and stuff.
Well, what's the question? Is this H bar effect? Yeah, so.
I know, but then.
Yeah. But that is our main point. I mean, to project out the source, yes, and this source of CP violation is certainly is this is spin conserving, yes. And now of course you might get some mixture, yes. So if you
equation across the boundary from one
medium to another. I mean, it just would mean that you put here a matrix, yes, which connects the two spins, yes, so that would be a possibility, yes, and if you want to...
I mean, you told us the bubble walls of interest are thick, so
yeah.
Isn't the issue that you actually have collisional dynamics during the transition of some fermion across that bubble wall?
But
this is thrown out because this gamma acts on the afterwards, you know. So
well, it's not. No, it's, I mean, there's still. I mean, you still have your set variable here. Yes, so it's not in this sense. It's not acting afterwards. But we assume that it also. We just can put it in here with spin conservation. Yes. So otherwise, one would have to mix the two equations for the two spins. Yes. I mean, it's.
But the transformation it happens at within the interface, and then its question is
we are still in the interface. The differential equation is in the interface.
Important in the interface, you know, the coherence.
Yeah, it is important. It is important. I mean, if you have to solve this equation here, and what we have put in is now here's the source. Yes, I mean that is what I had to argue at the beginning. What is the source here? Yeah, and this source is spin conserving. Yes, and now. Here, this piece is not, yes, in general, yes, so, yeah. Okay, then, we get then a typical source terms of this type, yes, U1 and U2, these are rescaled Higgs expectation values, and you also can look to second order effect. Then, of course, it's not a surprise that you find something similar to what we had before, yes, with the semi-classical source, yes, so this H-bar square effect. The bosonic case one can also do, I skip. And but here are now some remarks, yes, I mean, there is also discussion with Carlos Wagner and his group. I mean, the collision term in our case is practically has the sense of getting some damping. Yeah? But we do not extract at all CP violation from the collision term. And now you could come to the idea, I know the damping of the collision term, and now with the same term I try to introduce CP violation, but that can be completely wrong, yes, because of course CP, if you have a damping, you have not time reversal invariant, so you can get some artificial thing of what you could call CP violation, but which is not true. So there are real effects of CP violation, but we have analyzed, and they are rather complicated, and in our case it was always because you have the scattering, and so it was smaller, it was suppressed a little bit, yes, compared to our effect. Yeah? But one has to be careful, and so it's not okay if you introduce your CP violation using as a prefactor fixed law. Yes, you take fixed law, and that way you normalize, yes, your CP violation. These are completely different effects. Okay, and okay, and then of course there's still some work to do. I mean, you generate now these charginos, and now these charginos, they enter in ordinary diffusion equations, which you can derive, and they are already known since Will Nelson, and also here's the group around Carlos has used them. So there's nothing spectacular going on, and at the end of this diffusion, you have then kind of a difference between the left-handed quarks in the antiparticle. So you really have chiral asymmetry, and since this chiral asymmetry, the left-handed quarks enter the sphaleron, they are then transformed into a baryon asymmetry, which has to freeze out pretty fast, and you have formulas for that, and you can proceed. Oh, these are the equations, and now here these are our results and concrete calculations. So this is for the MSSM. For the MSSM, and we have here taken, there, of course, the MSSM, you can have different parameters here, yeah? You see only here this black region. Yes, if you take maximal CP violation, of course, that you don't know, and there's a big discussion going on, if there are some calculating the dipole moments, electric dipole moments, if there are some cancellations or not. Yes, so here just we took maximal CP violation, and then the allowed area is just this black one. Yeah, and so what is plotted here? This is the weak Gacino mass, and this is the mu parameter, and you see only in this area here you find satisfying results, and the whole calculation, of course there are many open points in a sense, so one should be careful. For example, this diffusion equations are pretty big, yes, and you have to make assumptions what is in equilibrium and what is not, yeah, of all these particles. So we can, if you are working hard enough, I mean, you can pinpoint all these things, yes, and you get really clear results. And also let me show you here a figure which is a little bit more detailed. I mean, so this eta 10 should be around 1, yes, if you have the observed baryon number. And now we have here a couple of sources. This SD is the quasi-classical source. And ABC are these other sources. And I didn't point that out clear enough. I mean, in these equations we got, these equations have been very similar to neutrino equations, where you have rotation, yes, where you have a rotation in flavor space. And this is the important effect which led us to this H-bar, to the first order effect. And but you see, so there are quite a few here, and actually it's not exactly, you don't have the maximum, not exactly if mu is equal to M2, but there's a difference, and these are also not really, in the sense here, maxima. It goes to zero here, and you have a rather complicated situation. And this is here done for a damping alpha w u times tc, and here some smaller damping. If you have smaller damping, you get here these. If you have smaller damping, then you get here a steeper maximum. And what is interesting in this case, then, here this quasi-classical forces. If you are not really at this degeneracy point, yeah, in your parameter space, then this quasi-classical force is winning. Yeah, so the old case is winning. And but this this figure here then looks similar to what you find in the papers of Carlos Varnas and his group. And but if you look in detail and say agree now, yes, and Seco, who cooperated with us, yes, was in the group before, so we all agree that this is the right way to do.
This damping you're talking about, that's this parameter you put in?
Yeah, yeah.
And so by just increasing the damping a bit, you could just diminish it to 0.5 or lower?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if you damp stronger, yes, yeah. Cool. Yeah, yeah. But not this, yeah, the damping is important,
so
yes.
How do you know that you're in a range of damping where you could observe?
Very difficult, yes. I mean, so of course, this is a rather natural scale here, yes. So, but it's difficult to tell, yes. So it's difficult to tell. Okay. So, I mean, if you want to avoid all these problems, yes, of course, you can go to this next to minimal models, yes, then you have more parameter space and you have more parameters, and it's not so restrictive at all, yes. And so, for example, here, I would not say that I like these plots where you have the number of models which do it or not. But anyway, you see here in one half of these models, you can find enough baryogenesis, which means eta 10 would be here equal to 1, yes, in one half of the models. And then you also can look for the you can look what about the restrictions on CP violation, yes, and so you get another one half, but it's a reasonable number, yes. So that, but of course, this is all waiting for experiments, yes, so it's not so clear, yeah. Let me see, I have still 10 minutes for the other part. And now this is coherent baryogenesis. So we switch to a completely different situation, yes. Now, what I want to argue is that you have a scalar field condensate with a time-dependent mass matrix, which induces a time-dependent mass matrix, and then you produce particles. You produce particles and introducing CP violation. Yes, you also can that way introduce some asymmetry. You can introduce some asymmetry, which then later on is transformed into baryon asymmetry. So this is the idea. Yeah? And this sounds completely different. So in the concrete case, I mean, here this time dependence will come because you consider inflation. You have inflationary field, yes, and so this is time dependent. And okay, then you have to put into this formalism some CP violation. And okay, and now comes again a strong assumption, yes. You assume that your inflation field, huh, is homogeneous, which of course is only true in some average sense, yes. So what we assume is homogeneous, and then if you look close, then your transport equations, which you write down, are very, very similar to what you have done before. Now, in this other case where we went to the Wolfram, we just had the set dependence. We had the set dependence of the perpendicular to the wall, yes? And now if you exchange that with time, yes, then you have very similar equations. And there they are. And now, of course, you need, it's again for the fermionic case, and you have a mass matrix which has a Hermitian, anti-Hermitian part, and what is important that now you cannot define a phase, it's a CP violating phase because the mass and the derivative of the mass do not compute. So this is much beyond the Yalskog way to get CP violation. And you also get something similar to this spin conservation. Now this, instead of spin is helicity, yes, but otherwise it's, and again you neglect for a while the collision term. Yeah? That's also the same. Yeah? And now in this case, you do not have, in this sense, a derivative expansion, but you take your momentum. Yes, you take the lowest momenta here, and then you have four of these quantities. The most important one is the one fixed helicity with a zero on it, which is again zero component of a vector. And then you have such a set of equations, which is not trivial. Yeah? So it's if you would try to evaluate, yes, analytically, yes, I mean substituting here these quantities to the others, one, we tried for a long time, we didn't succeed. Yes, so we solved it numerically, yeah? And so also some diploma students later on, so many people have tried that. Now it's an interesting set of equations, and now of course you also have to tell where the CP violation is entering, and for that one has to consider models. Yes, and these matrices here contain CP violating phases, and then it's a very you have to start with zero particles, which gives you some condition here for these Fs, and you end up with such a quantity here, F0 AA, that you extract from your program, which is kind of a charge, yes? It's a zeroth component of a vector, and it's a charge of a mode with momentum K and helicity H. And indeed, I mean, in these Lagrangians we considered there is a symmetry, so the charge is conserved, so the sum of the, if you have two, for example, you have two objects here, A is 1 and 2, then the sum is zero, so you always have some control. And this is then applied to hybrid inflation, yes? And now hybrid inflation, there are many possibilities. I like hybrid inflation because it's so elegant and it connects you to gut physics. And in particular, if you make it supersymmetric, then you already have for free your scalar fields, and so it's quite a nice model. And we have looked here to several examples, which I will not tell you. It's Patti Salam, SO10 or SO5 times U1 or so, several cases, yes? And they all have in common that you have here a superpotential which contains the inflaton field, which is the neutral field, and then some waterfall fields, yeah, which then break some symmetry. And so, for example, then gut symmetry. And
the collision is approximation during inflation or after inflation?
Let's discuss it a little bit later, yeah, again. Yeah? So up to now, we are solving our... No, it's all at the end of inflation. We are talking about the end of inflation.
The preheating rate.
Yes, we are talking in the preheating. It's a similar discussion. Is very similar to what we had before, but maybe we have it just after a minute. Yeah. So, well, this is hybrid inflation. You know it all. So here, okay, you can look to these models. Of course, you know I show you this page because one has to also to introduce the CP violation. Yes, and so this was our original piece here. And so you introduce here CP violating terms if zeta and psi are complex. Yeah? They carry some phases. And okay, and then you extract from these models the Dirac fermion mass. And here that would be for the Patisson-Lamm model. We have here a fermionic 2x2 mass, which is CP violating because you have these psi's and zetas here. And okay, and then you start your program. Yes, you start your program and you calculate. And now comes Jürgen's questions. Yeah? Jürgen's questions. We have the inflaton field. Yes, or in this case, there are two inflaton fields, if you like. It's the waterfall field and the other one. And now, of course, they undergo, they're just, they have ordinary perturbative decay, but more rapidly, you have also preheating. Yeah? You have preheating effects. Yeah? And so they are strongly damped. They are strongly damped, and of course, the as we have seen figures, I mean that the field is getting very inhomogeneous. Yes, but that means that you have a homogeneous component plus other component which corresponds to particle production, as I understand. Yeah, and so if you just look to the homogeneous component, you have some damping, and we have here we have introduced. Some damping. I mean, this is still here. The this is still our. But we have to introduce here towards the end. We introduce some damping. And okay, it's again. You have felicity conservation. Yeah, that is not true for this damping. Yeah. So, in principle, you also would have this mix. Yeah. So, but. In this sense, this discussion is very similar, yeah. But here, I mean, here it comes. The question is here. I mean, what is the CP violation producing? Yeah? And for the CP violation, this should not play a role. Yeah? So the CP violation is related. To these mass matrices, yes, and so. But I agree. I mean, in principle, one would have to solve, yes, that's a full system. Yes, you have what I have written down, plus collision terms, and the collision terms mix and the helicities. Yeah? Okay, and here's some result. I mean, you have a charge which depends on the. Here on the momentum, yes, and as I said, I mean the charges of the two fermions are opposite, and so this is an effect of CP violation, that you get here something unequal to zero, yes. Without CP violation, you would get zero. And well, here's also some parameters, but of course this is from some other model, and now, of course, you want me to explain how I get baryon asymmetry. The baryon asymmetry is now that these two particles, one and two, yeah, they have to decay, and they are not. There's no symmetry between. I mean, we have two particles, yeah, and then these two particles have different decays, and in between, they also decay into Majorana neutrinos. And this gives you a lepton number violation. This gives you a lepton number violation. And so this is not not the way, I mean, you're working in thermal leptogenesis. In thermal leptogenesis, the lepton number violation, this lepton asymmetry, yeah? Lepton asymmetry comes from the first. From a loop graph, yes, interference or decay of Majorana neutrinos, and then you have an interference between tree term and loop term. That's completely different formalism. And so we don't need that here because we have already our CP violation in this in the starting point, in our starting equations. And okay, you produce these Majorana neutrinos, and then you can calculate what is B minus L, and then after the Sveilerom process, you calculate your baryon asymmetry. And now, of course, there's then also some rather complicated estimate. I mean, how much, I mean, this is the original baryon asymmetry you produce here, and then you, of course, you have the universe is extending. Yes, it's not that you produce the quarks, the final quarks, yes, with a click, yes, so it takes some time, yes, and so you have to take this into account. And so I would have here something, but I think this is too much. And okay, and then you also can, of course, get something like non-thermal leptogenesis in the same model, yes, but then it's a different philosophy. You would have, again, hybrid inflation, and you produce your Majorana neutrinos. Yeah? And now you don't have this asymmetry arguments, just to produce your Majorana neutrinos to check if they are in equilibrium or not. Then you have thermal or non-thermal, and then you let them decay, CP violating like Buchmüller, Yanagida, and so on. Yeah? And you can make an estimate, and then sometimes we get out that this effect is smaller than our effect. Sometimes it's not so clear, yeah, but it's a completely different effect. And so I come to my conclusions. I hope I made you clear that if you want to generate a baryon asymmetry, you have to combine rather detailed information. So it's in this sense different from what you do if you talk about inflation and structure formation. You know, rather detailed information you have to combine, and information from elementary particle physics and cosmology. The elementary particle physics is momentarily in a bad shape, yes, so we don't know about these non-standard things, yes, so one has still to wait. Yeah? And transport theory plays a strong role. And since it's not unique at all what you are doing, so maybe it helps that you construct models which also explain your other features in cosmology. For example, you could, in this hybrid inflation model, also have something for inflation and grad unification. So you have a few more things to check. And but there are also common effects. Most aspects are beyond the standard model, and you have the Sveilerom in action, yes? And but, of course, the two models I presented, you are really at opposite ends. In modified electroweak theory, you have a phase boundary, strong first-order phase transition. In the other case, you talk about inflation and gut. And you have non-equilibrium at a completely different energy scale. And you need the Majorana neutrino, which is, I think, is a good point. I mean, the good point for electroweak theory is that you were talking about physics which is testable, yes, in near future, yes. So, the nice thing is with the other model, I mean, that you have this Majorana neutrino is deeply related to neutrino physics, and they naturally violate lepton numbers. So that is something, a big advantage. Well, I hope I could argue that it's an interesting field, and we are slowly going on with these problems. Yeah? Thank you.
Mike. I like
SO10
too.
Yeah. Yeah, SO10 is nice, yeah. Yeah.
There's a potential problem with that SO10 model, which is formation of cosmic strings. If you break the SO2 right with a triplet, you'll get a string.
Yeah, yeah.
Strings that
some strings of the gut scale which decay appreciably into standard model particles are not healthy. Cosmic rays.
Well, we took versions where people discuss that, yes, of course, yes, people discuss that, yes. That's a problem with all these models where you have ground unification, yes, so you should not produce the British strings, yeah?
The problem is that these strings produce, is it cosmic rays?
Yes, there's a kind of debate about it, but either they decay to gravitational radiation, in which case gut scale strings are already ruled out by the big second pulsar, or they decay into, some fraction of them decay into standard model particles plus invisible particles. And I think that if you have an SO10 model, then that fraction is higher.
But that's a major issue, for example, Kaiser Scharfe or so. For them, it's since they are, that's their main point, yes, and so they look to that, yes. But otherwise, the SO10 is quite nice, yes.
Difficult to believe
the SO10 doesn't. Yeah. It's one of the points in Hans-Peter Nilis, the golden rules of model builders, yes, take SO10, yes, so there's some other advices. So.